Hello everyone, this is Deirdre, and this is the second episode of Badlands Broadcast, a plebeian trash production. Today I'm going to be talking about three different subjects. Our card of the week, Magic the Gathering this time, sigils and their versatility in disabled life, and our intersectional feminism topic of the week, sex work. As always, if you have any questions, please contact me on Tumblr at hagofthebadlands and send a message or ask. That's hagofthebadlands.tumblr.com. I decided that I wanted to alternate Magic the Gathering and tarot cards because sometimes, like this episode, I'll be focusing more on other issues rather than how it intersects fandom and nerddom, but I wanted to keep this channel a blend of topics, so I think this will help balance things. Anyway, our Magic card of the week is One with the Machine, which features Tezzeret in its art and was chosen because I thought of one of my friends while making this and wanted to give a shout out to them because they're awesome. Anyway, One with the Machine. This card costs 4, 3 generic and a blue. It is a sorcery and says, draw cards equal to the highest converted mana cost among artifacts you control. Its flavor text is, when I grafted the planar bridge into myself, I felt my planeswalker spark flare beyond my body. The multiverse was my plaything. It felt incredible. This card was printed in Core Set 2019, it is a rare, and the art was done by Chase Stone. Now, from a Magic the Gathering stance, this card is great value. 4 is a little expensive depending on format and mana ramp capability, but if you're running any kind of affinity for artifacts or even Esper artifacts, I can see this card being very useful. From a metaphysical standpoint, and I'll admit I'm brainstorming on my end for building my Magic the Gathering divination deck, this card indicates several things to me. First off, the cost. This is a mid-game card designed to give you advantage over others. It is also a sorcery, and as I mentioned in the previous episode, sorceries are transient events that can drastically affect our lives. I interpret this information as this card appearing in situations of manipulation, similar to the Seven of Swords in the Rider-Waite Tarot. Unlike the Seven of Swords, however, I would wager this card is more of exploiting an opportunity, and while it does give advantage over others, this could very well be a good thing. For example, you gain a promotion and now have managerial capabilities to reprimand a particularly unhelpful, non-working former coworker. Of course, if this card were inverted, I would definitely read it as a maliciously manipulating circumstances in your favor. I think I want to include aspects of flavor text as I interpret cards as well. In this instance, Tezzeret is speaking about how a surge of power has made him feel euphoric. This plays well into the interpretation of the card being one of advantage and manipulation. I'll probably come up with more as I meditate more on this card, but for now, that's my hot take. Moving on from that, I want to talk about something personally important to me that I think will help others. I'm a disabled person, and part of that includes constant fatigue. I'm not alone in this. Many disabled people, whether that disability is mental or physical, experience fatigue as one of their symptoms. Because of this, I can't always express my practice in ways I'd like. I was, for lack of a better term, raised on traditional witchcraft, Crowley, the Order of the Roses, Gardner, etc. I have moved away from much of that and totally denounced Dianic witchcraft, mainly because of the misogyny and transmisogyny and transphobia. Like, let's face it, Gardner was a creepy old man who wanted to have sex with young women, as were many of these organized ceremonial magic circles. And Dianic witchcraft, though supposedly woman-oriented, has proven itself to be very cis-sexist and transmisogynistic. I guess the spirituality is there, the craft is there, but much of it is expressed in a way that I'm now comfortable saying is not something I want to include in my craft anymore. So anyway, those were my first influences, along with Catholicism growing up. Thus, the idea of ritual is important to me and something I like to include in my practice. Ritual here just means a set of practices done in a specific way or order, not necessarily a group of people performing certain acts. Ritual, however, takes a lot out of you. It is organized and specific and requires planning and dedication. Sometimes I just cannot dedicate that much time, energy, and mental or spiritual energy to such a task. After I got sick, I began to look into other forms of magic and came across the sigil. I watched a fascinating YouTube video once by Grant Morrison, a Scottish comic book writer and playwright, which I have included below. The video is quite long, though I have it set up so the video starts as he begins talking about sigil magic. There is a condensed version of just the sigil magic. However, the user that published that shortened video uses anti-Semitic dog whistles, and I'm just not comfortable including that in my show. So my technique, influenced by Morrison, is to write a sentence of intent, then eliminate all vowels, then eliminate all duplicate letters, and finally taking the remaining letters and crafting them into a symbol of intent. I usually let my artistic mind take control and arrange things in aesthetically pleasing ways. I am a little superstitious, actually, about accepting sigils from others, because I feel they are so personalized that if you were to take a sigil crafted by someone else, without ill intent on the part of the crafter, it may have adverse effects because their focus is different than yours. Now, I'm sure many people have used sigils others have crafted with success and no ill effects, but I thought I'd share a warning anyway. It usually takes me an hour or so to craft a sigil now, and that I have the hang of it, but bringing this back to disabled life, taking an hour while sitting down using only mental focus is a lot less taxing than setting up a ritual space, gathering all your materials, cleansing the space, using tools, etc. Some people burn their sigils to release their energy, or eat them, or bury them. I think this is up to the practitioner as to what works. Personally, to save energy resources, I've taken to taping or gluing my finalized sigil onto a candle. I use the tall glass encased kind, but a taper or even a votive candle could work should you choose this approach. Other sigils are meant to be permanent, such as wards. So you create an etch or carve it or create a permanent recreation and then utilize it accordingly. Sigils provide disabled witches with ways to practice their craft and express their intent without strenuous effort. Plus, it is entirely personalized. I think it's easy, especially when you have chronic fatigue, to get stuck in a rut where you only use other people's spells or rituals or give up on your craft entirely. And I think this is a great way to get back into things and continue your craft. Honestly, I think disabled people are left out of so many spaces, except the ones we create ourselves. There is a growing number of disabled witches who use technomancy or emoji spells or other modern magics as an alternative to more traditional witchcraft techniques. Again, we create our own spaces, so it's time for the greater witchcraft community to allow us integration and to take these practices seriously and not as a lesser form of magic. I've seen many witches who are neurotypical or have better functioning than their other disabled counterparts who do look down on sigil magic because it's too easy or not intense enough or whatever. This is simply not true. Some of my most powerful spells have included sigil magic. While I wouldn't necessarily replace an entire ritual with a sigil, I would substitute aspects of it. Hell, I've even done some emoji spells in the past with great success. I just think, overall, that inclusiveness in any aspect of life is better than exclusion, and the witchcraft community is no different. That's pretty much all I have to say on the subject, but feel free to ask questions about this or any topic. Moving on, I wanted to talk about our intersectional feminist topic of the week, sex work. First, I am not currently a sex worker, though I am not ashamed to admit that I've sold video and pictures in the past, as well as done some camera work. However, I cannot speak for all sex workers, especially those currently working in the field, and while I have tried to approach this subject in the most respectful way possible, I am fallible, and should I step out of my lane, please tell me. So now, let's define sex work. Wikipedia defines sex work as the exchange of sexual services, performances, or products for material compensation. It includes activities of direct physical contact between buyers and sellers, as well as indirect sexual stimulation. Sex work is a booming industry, and it includes a variety of workers, from full-service sex workers who are paid by private clients to engage in sex acts, to camming services, to selling pictures. So, why is sex work important? Well, In a feminist lens, we must strive for equality and equity for all persons, especially the most vulnerable in our communities. Now, sex workers are vulnerable not because of the sex work per se, but because of the stigma. Oliver Thorne of YouTube channel Philosophy Tube interviewed Riley Reyes, an adult performer and chair of APAC, the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee. She said the greatest danger, aside from sex work being illegal, is stigma. Stigma prevents sex workers from receiving proper medical care. Stigma prevents sex workers from seeking help in dangerous situations. And stigma enables the exploitation of sex workers, from pimping to pornographers to unscrupulous club owners. Stigma also prevents former sex workers from being able to secure jobs outside of sex work, leaving many of the most vulnerable members of that community at high risk. Now, on to the next most dangerous part of sex work, the legality. Keeping sex work illegal is, to most people, wrong, because it criminalizes a valid occupation and opens up the door to exploitation. Legalization, on the other hand, takes the power away from the sex worker, and laws targeting only clients only serves to further drive the sex work industry underground. Decriminalization, on the other hand, keeps sex workers safer by keeping them able to work for themselves without bureaucracy and keeps them out of jail. Of course, SWERFs, or sex worker exclusionary radical feminists, would argue that sex work should be illegal to protect women. Now, there are issues in the sex work industry. Trafficking exists, assault exists, but making it or keeping it illegal is not the answer. For one thing, say a trafficked person who is forced into full-service sex work wants to get help. With that being illegal, the trafficked person is more likely to end up in jail rather than get the help they need. And I can't cover why the prison industrial complex is so bad right now, but maybe I will one of these episodes. Anyway, sex work is a valid occupation, and we should listen to sex workers when they talk about how they want to engage in their profession. And we should all tell a SWERF to fuck off. They're usually reactionary in general. They're awful. So that's about it for tonight's show. I hope you learned something new, or at least from a new perspective.